Disposable Heroes is brought to you by Beard Booze. From the very beginning, they decided that all their products would be made from 100% natural and organic ingredients. You know, some companies use like oils and like additives and whatnot, but they chose they're not going to go that route. It's going to be individualized hand-drawn labels on all their products, all original, and exactly what they believe their customers will enjoy. So after countless hours of research, development, and tireless testing, Beard Booze was born. To this day, they continue to put their hearts and souls into their products and building relationships with their customers. So go check them out. Yasad has his own personalized Beard Booze line, and they have 100% all-natural ingredients, beeswax, coconut oil, shea butter, sweet almond oil. It's good for your skin, it's good for your beard, and it smells amazing. So check them out. Beardbooze.com. That's beardbooze with a Z.com.
Disposable Heroes, Episode 4, with a good friend of mine, Adam O'Rourke. Here's what's going to go down. Beef takes over the studio. How boredom turned into a board game that will insult the filthiest of jokesters. Adam also tells us what it was like being the Phil Collins of thrash metal. And just a lot of good old thrash metal talk all around. Enjoy. All right. How is everyone doing out there? Aloha. This is episode 4 of Disposable Heroes. I've got, of course, Mitch over here. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. And we want to thank the special guest today, Adam O'Rourke. How are you doing, man? Hey, thanks so much. High energy, always.
That's high energy.
From the time I've met you back in the 2 cents days, that's all it was, man. That's all it was.
I'm phenomenal, man. We're down here with a bunch of bulldogs and some good friends. I mean, how could I be anything but whimsically magnificent?
Right. It's all about the whimsical magnifique is what we're all about here. But hey, man, thanks so much for driving down.
Absolutely, sure.
We appreciate it. So just a little bit of history, I think, about Adam is he is, to put in a nutshell, like we were talking about earlier, is, I guess, a different form of your disposable hero. He was actually the lead singer and drummer of the band he was in when I met him probably in 2001 or so.
Yeah.
A band called 2 Cents.
Yeah.
So tell me about those times when we first met and everything that was going on with you in when you were, as we were saying earlier, the Don Henley of thrash metal.
Yeah. Well, I was, I was a singing drummer for a band with probably the worst band name I've ever heard in the history of band names, 2 Cents. I don't even know why we kept it. We always fucking hated it. We were like, this is the lamest name ever. We're like, we're going to change it. We're like, nah, whatever. But, no, it was good times, man. It was just, those were the early days of making and creating music. And it was all about just, being passionate about what you did and reckless abandon and not really, which is, punk rock is what got me into music. I never listened to a fucking Kansas record and went, oh, I can do that.
Right. But when you say punk rock, that's what got you into music, got you into drumming.
Yeah, got me into, I just took a look at it and I was like, man, it's just really about, saying, fuck it, I could fuck it, go, and crash. Actually, what got me into drumming was Animal from the Muppets.
Yes.
I was like, you're telling me all I have to do is break shit and chew on cymbals and I can get laid? I'm fucking in.
Nice.
But
I love it because it's a different take on the stereotypical, why did you join a band, man?
Yeah. No, and then funny enough, the first drum set I ever got, I was like 4 years old. My parents got me a Muppet Baby drum set.
Nice.
And they set it up for me, and they like unveiled it to me, Price is Right style on Christmas morning.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, ah! And I ran in the other room, grabbed a hammer, and just beat the shit out of it and broke it in 2 seconds. And my parents were like, fuck.
No shit.
But I thought that's what you were supposed to do with it.
Right.
And my approach to drumming really hasn't changed since.
Goddamn Sesame Street.
Drumming or masturbating. You just go ham.
Oh, exactly. It's go forward and learn from your mistakes, right?
Exactly. But no, those were magical times, man, because there was so many cool bands coming up. We got to meet you, Pepper. You guys, there's a band called The Deviates coming up in the South Bay back in the day. And the punk rock scene was just like massive and exploding, and all these crazy new bands were coming out and new sounds, and it hit yet to reach a point where it kind of cannibalized itself and became, you know, a thing of pop culture phenomenon.
Right. And it's so funny because music seems to do that in cycles, you know what I mean? Something will get real big and then it'll cannibalize itself and then it'll move on to the next thing. And kind of jumping around for that really quick, I know we're talking about the past, but jumping to the future, or not the future, but the present and the future. Right now you're in the middle of an EDM project, I guess you'd say, right? With Brody Jenner.
Yeah. Well, Brody's been one of my best friends. I grew up with Brody, and Brody used to actually play in a like comedy blues rock band when he was 15 years old called Face Humper. And I would give him drum lessons. Drum lessons back in the day, and it was brutal shit. It was like that. I could equate it to like the Rolling Stones version of Tenacious D, you know? So he's always been a passionate music lover.
Yeah.
And, so it's not necessarily when you say EDM, people get like a picture in their mind of, you know, these very kind of sappy, corny, like poppy sounding things. Like a lot of the music we make, most of the music we make, is very like aggressive and very bass heavy. And the reason I got into that whole music is in 2000, you know, Pantera is one of my favorite bands of all time. All time.
Yeah, God bless. Seriously.
Yeah.
They are one of my favorites of all time as well.
And I remember the first time I heard a song called Equinox by Skrillex. It was literally the most aggressive and just bold, ballsy thing I'd ever heard. And what I really stuck out to me is he took the riff from By Demons Be Driven by Pantera,
right,
like almost verbatim, and he fed it through this massive synthesizer and this bass thing, and it came out, and it just to me it sounded like, you know, if you would have walked into the Star Wars metal bar 2,000 years from now and seen that version of Pantera, what that would have been like. So it was very much the aggression and the tonality of what was being accomplished there that got me into it. So,
and I just say EDM, I guess, for lack of a better term, too.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. So I'll say this. To me, I'm heavily versed on all of that stuff now.
Uh-huh.
And to me, it's still fucking ridiculous how many different names they have for it.
Right.
You know, it's just fucking absurd. It's the same thing with like hardcore back in the day. It was like, we're post pre-modern pop prefixed hardcore. It's like, shut the fuck up. You're hardcore. Yeah. All right. You're just a fucking hardcore band. Just because you use like an augmented seventh, I don't give a fuck. You don't need to add an adjective to it.
Yeah.
Dickhead.
Right.
You're fucking hardcore. Yeah. So, you know, I get it. For a lot of people, EDM just means electronic music that you can dance to. So 100%. Under the umbrella of that, that is absolutely what we're doing. But unfortunately, a lot of people think of like super poppy, like Selena Gomez-y type songs.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the
chain smokers, whatever the current thing is.
And a lot of the stuff I work on, everything I normally work on outside of like the acoustic stuff I do is just really aggressive sounding that would like put most people off. I guess is the best way to describe it.
And because Mitch here, he kind of dabbles in that world a lot too. And I mean, yeah. Pretty much, he works with a band called Tritonal.
Nice.
That's in
they're the glitzy poppy side.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're not poppy, but their songs are not. They're lush and not aggressive.
Right? Yeah.
Are you familiar with them? Right.
Yeah, it sounds super familiar. The name. I'm sure if you brought me up a track, I would.
It's just so amazing.
It's like Chainsmokers-y.
Yeah, and yeah. Dude, I'll say this: I got nothing but. You know, I got nothing but respect for those guys, and I like a lot of their songs. You know, one of the worst things that punk rock did a lot of, gave me the best things in my life and then gave me the worst things in my life simultaneously. And it gave me these very just ridiculous opinions about it, what was cool and what was not cool and what was acceptable and what was not acceptable. Shit that's just based in just absolute fucking garbage nonsense. And you get to a certain age and you start to realize that opinions can be prisons. You know what I mean?
Totally.
It's not based on anything. Now I love the fact it's like, I'll fucking, dude, I love Taylor Swift Blank Space. If you pull up next to me in the 405, there's a 50% chance I'm going, do you want to go forever?
Yeah.
Or I'll be fucking blasting Slayer, or I'll be blasting Ghastly, or, you know, it's like, it doesn't fucking matter. It's like, I love everything.
Right.
And I have an appreciation for everything. And people want to rag, if certain people want to rag the Chainsmokers, man, it's like to accomplish the production on some of those songs is pretty incredible.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I got to... For me personally, dude, I'm all about a.
You got to record this. The I know noise she's making is just, or he's making.
I know we've oh got we've oh got God. A.
Yeah, he's gonna go. He's gonna. For the record, for the listeners at yeah. home, we have my bulldog, Sir Beefy McWellington. His wow. Is trying to go ham on a leg.
Yeah, on my leg.
Yeah. Yeah, and he is just a beauty of a bulldog.
He is,
man.
Man, that was aggressive. You yeah. wasted no time.
No
buddy.
Beef.
Oh, here we go again.
Beef, beef down. Beef. Yeah, I feel so beef. Bad. His balls are so full.
I know.
I wish I could do something for you, buddy.
No, but I was just going to say, I mean, for the record, the way I look at things is if anyone's out there doing their thing
yeah.
and doing well with it, and that means whether you're being successful with yourself or with the rest of the world, either way, if you're doing your thing, I'm all about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
So I think I wanted to, when I was saying he's in it, it's just such a different world to me. The that you know, for like I said, the umbrella term of the EDM world.
Yeah.
And we touched on it when I last saw you, Adam, a little bit, for how you are actually making sounds that are have never been heard before, basically.
Well, let me jump in. So this yeah. is why I fucking really got obsessed with electronic music in general is you know, I'm going to back up a little. Rock music's fucking dead. It just doesn't exist anymore. And yeah. I'll tell you why rock music doesn't exist anymore, in a sense, is every fucking band is using the exact same guitar tones and exact same hooks and the exact same pre-choruses. And it's the same. Name me a band that's come out in the past 10 years that's a fucking rock band. I'll give you 60 seconds. That has actually made an impact. I'm sure there's a band at a local bar. But, I mean, they just fucking said, oh, this works. In a lot of ways, that's why we stopped doing 2 cents in a sense. It's like, we loved it, but like, I got kind of detached from the scene. And in a lot of ways, a lot of that shit just became a parody of itself. And it's like, oh, cool. Do you have a fucking double stacked Marshall? Can you do a double bass roll? Can you growl like my fucking bulldog? Yeah. Congratulations.
Right.
You could put a gun to my fucking head and be like, what band is this? And I'd be like, ah. You know what I mean?
Well, what would be the last like one, like a Slipknot or something like that?
There's a perfect example of a kill. Like, you put on Slipknot, you know it's fucking Slipknot. You put on Pennywise, you know it's Pennywise. It's like, that's the hallmark of a true artist. You listen to Pepper within 10 fucking seconds, that's Pepper. That's what you got to strive for to be an artist. And the cool thing, necessarily rounding it back into electronic music, is electronic music is constantly about... In like from week to week, innovating. Can we make a new noise? Can I make a new sound? Can I do something that hasn't been done? Can I stretch it out? And granted, it does fall very much like any songwriting. There's a formula where there's a build and a drop, and there's things that occur in most songs. But it's, in my opinion, it's the style of music now where you have people who are every single day trying to push the envelope and trying to come out with something that hasn't been done and hasn't been heard before. And it really tickles the geek side of my mind, because I love sitting in a room with a drum set and a guitar and fucking sweating and blasting out. That's what got me into music, and I love it. On the flip side of that, opening a program like Serum, which is a VST, and starting with a raw just waveform and taking this one sound that sounds like and then grabbing it and adding stuff to it and building onto it and stretching it out and ripping it apart and like doing this thing that when you're done constructing this sound, you can hit the F on your keyboard controller and it sounds like it could tear down a fucking wall. I mean, That's a pretty interesting thing to get lost in, and I can sit there for 6 hours just fucking around with one noise.
Right. So EDM, really, or when you start with to write an electronic music song, it really starts with just a.
Well,
you can.
I mean, if you're gonna build a patch from scratch, there's obviously presets, which is just like. You know, there's predetermined sounds that people have already built that you can take and modify. And then a lot of what people do too is they can take samples and then they take a sample, they cut up the sample and stretch it out and do it. But it's constantly like balancing and tweaking and geeking stuff out to make it sound like, because look, what you're really doing is trying to fuck with people on drugs, which I love. I love, you're just trying to fuck with people on drugs. And then if you could get somebody who's not on drugs to feel like they're on drugs, that's amazing. Because then the person who's on drugs is just going to be just music to get people to like headbang and heavy pet themselves simultaneously.
Right.
Gotcha. That should be your first album title. Yeah. Headbanging and heavy petting.
Yeah. That's amazing. But it's just so good to talk to you about something like that. Well, just, I just love talking to you about music in general because you've got such a keen mind for it, in my opinion. So getting your translation of that world to me makes, it just makes a lot of sense to me. You know what I mean? Where it's such like a foreign thing.
Well, I hear so much of, I'll say this. You go to these festivals now, it's funny, you go to these quote-unquote EDM festivals, they're doing the Wall of Death there. They have massive mosh pits. It's fucking transformed into the new form of rock and roll because it's the last place where you can get new, aggressive sounding music, which to me is fucking mind-blowing. In the state of the world today, how it is, the fact that there's not 30 bands that not sound like Rage Against the Machine but have the spirit and tenacity and the middle finger up everywhere like a Rage Against the Machine is void. Right. Everything's like, let's fucking party and drink beers and Lamborghinis.
Right.
It's like, it's fucking weird.
Right.
The one thing I will say then, talking mild shit about that style of music, is it is very surface level, cerebral, you know what I mean? There's not a lot of lyrics to it, and there's not that depth that you get with like a killer rock record when someone really pens a fucking like Testify by Rage Against the Machine, when someone really pens something that like fucking hits you and moves you.
Right.
You know, it's more cerebral, it's more aggressive and about like making you visualize shit, which is cool, but it's the forefront, in my opinion. Certain genres of that bass music is the forefront of, like.
Now the Beefy McMillan.
Aggressive, yeah.
About to hump Usad as well. So yeah.
I don't know. We can put him out of the room. Beef! No,
he's.
So that you're talking about all these festivals and whatnot and how the spirit and everything that they are there. So this last weekend, you said you went out and you guys did an EDM festival at Lil Jon. What, take me through that a little bit. What, like, how does that festival play out, and what's the crowd like, or is that different than this?
Those are a little different than like straight up, like something like a Hard Summer that's coming up. That was kind of just like an outdoor, like it was in Montreal. It was super crazy cool. It was at a outdoor wakeboarding park, and there's about 5,000 people there. And the thing I love about it too is the vibe that's at those things is just insane.
Right.
It's just insane. Everybody's in a good mood. I've been to, I can't count how many of those things. You know how many times I've seen a fist fight or people talking shit to each other? Like, never.
Same thing with your experience?
That's a really good observation. Yeah, no, it's the exact same thing. Because I've done, with Tritonal, I also have done a little bit of Tommy Trash.
Yeah, I fucking love him.
So I did EDC with Tommy Trash.
Yeah.
And like EDC is just, I'd never been until this year. And I was just like, and I'd been to a lot of the other ones, but I was just like, this is like, you know, the Plur. Have you ever heard about Plur? Do you know what Plur is?
Yeah.
You know, peace, love, unity, respect.
Yes.
That's it, right?
That's a festival?
That's their mantra.
No, that's the motto of people.
Like the mantra for people that are into that.
Gotcha. Nice.
And that's kind of the way it is. There's a little bit more pretentiousness.
Sounds like a fish concert.
Yeah.
You know? Like, because it's so corporate and so popular.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a Coachella for electronic music.
Right.
But so there's a little bit more pretentiousness and like money. You know what I mean? But for the most part, the fans are the most dedicated and like happy to be there fans you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Right.
The reggae scene kind of has that thing.
Right.
But the energy is just so different.
I mean, I've walked through a festival before, literally like I've walked through a festival before. And granted, let's be honest. I mean, drugs do play a part, but they don't play the whole part. I mean, drugs are a part of the culture, and especially things like MDMA, which, you know, obviously makes people more agreeable to say the least. But I mean, it's more the mentality. It's like if you ran into those kids on the street when they weren't rolling their face off, it'd pretty much be the same thing. But I mean, I've like bumped into people randomly at a festival and wound up spending like 5 hours just rolling around with them. Like, oh, wait, like, I'm sorry, both of you. Oh, what's your name? Ha, ha, ha. And then you're like coupled up and you're like, let's mob to this stage. And then, You know, it's like you there's these weird, like, little microscopic adventures that have with complete strangers that you'll never see again, to where, I mean, I've been to a million and three rock shows and I do love it. It's a different energy. I'm not saying one's better than the other, but just the vibe and the idea of something like that happening is not the same. I'm sorry, guys. We can put him in the other room. Beef.
He loves me.
Beef
loves me.
You must put some really, like, nice lotion on or something.
Yeah.
He's just going to town on your leg right now.
Yeah. Sit. Must just be the bulldog vibes that I just constantly emulate.
Oh, that's what it is, dude. You have Mishka's pheromones just littered. Like, they're in your skin right now.
Yeah.
I bet.
He's just pumped.
Oh, I feel so bad.
We just love you, Beef. But that's amazing. It's like, I love that, because that's what I think music should be about. Like, that should be, I mean, I get it. There's super aggressive music and you know, people aren't, I mean, I guess going to be really, like, positive. I mean, it's a release.
Yeah.
Music like that is definitely a release to me. That's because when people, I think, turn aggressive music into violence, then they're missing the point.
Oh yeah,
as completely. Well, you know, because it's like no, you're supposed to let all that go.
Go.
That's what, you know what I mean. That's what it's all about.
At 2 cent shows, man, when people, I used to fuck it. I would always hate it when people got into a fight, but I'd always stop the song mid song, and then I'd do House Lights Up. I'd point them out and just embarrass the shit out of them. I'd be like, look, you're in here with all these fucking people, and you two dudes are locked up together. I'm like, that's some pretty questionable shit right there. I'm like, pretty much, if you're punching another guy in the face, you're just telling me you can't get pussy, brother.
Right.
And then the whole place is like, ah, and then they feel like a moron, and then we turn the lights back on, and then no one fights.
Right, right.
And I mean, I understand that was kind of crass and derogatory. The idea isn't to be like, go try to sexually harass women, but the idea is being like, you're in this beautiful, magical thing with all these people having a good time, and you're sitting here like now, like locked up with another guy punching him in the face, like, look around, pay attention to something else.
And no matter what it starts with, I think even the ones that turn into these big historic melees that you hear about, it only starts with a couple people at first, and it turns into, worst case scenario, these big horrible incidents, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, it just, it goes back to missing the point. But okay, now jumping back to what, you know, you mentioned 2 cents again. Let's talk about you and drumming and just like your favorite drummers and what got your drummer blood boiling when you were a young drummer.
Well, the first show I ever saw was Strung Out at the first punk show I ever saw was Strung Out at the Whiskey A Go-Go for the Suburban Teenage Wasteland opening.
Nice.
And Jordan,
what year was that?
94 or 95.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
No, 95, 96, maybe.
God, such good music coming out back then.
Dude, that's amazing. And that's when Jim Cherry was still in the band. I remember, like, the band called Redfish opened for him. But there was this part in Better Days when he goes, tonight I'll drink myself to sleep. And Jordan does this. And when he did that, Jason spit a loogie up in the air and perfectly caught it in his mouth by the time the fill was ending. And I was just like, I mean, my little prepubescent cock was so rock hard at that point in time. I could have cut through ice with it. It was just fucking, it was just on for me. That sold it. That's when I was like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Because the first concert I saw before that was phenomenal. I saw my first concert ever. I was 14 years old. I saw Nine Inch Nails playing the Downward Spiral tour. And at 7 o'clock at night, the first of four bands was this weird unknown guy no one had ever heard of called Marilyn Manson.
Right.
Came out and played. That shit blew me away, but it was such a spectacle, a meticulously executed spectacle in such a grand proportion.
Yeah.
I could have never conceived even attempting something like it.
Totally.
Because it was like a Broadway musical, and it was fucking magical. And I mean, Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails, for all intents and purposes, back in the day, put on some of the best shows ever. But then you went and you saw, even though Strung Out rips so hard. Rob and Jordan and all those guys are wizards at what they do, but there was something about being crowded in that little club and watching them 2 feet away from me and them sweating it out together that it just was like, that's what I want to do. And from that moment on, I went home. I'd already been playing drums at that point in time.
Yeah.
But at that moment I went home and I made up my mind. We started pretty much 2 cents like the day after I saw that show.
No way. And that was then you were about 14 or 15 then?
Yes, I was 15 years old
when the Strung Out show happened.
Yes.
So the Nine Inch Nails Marilyn Manson show was the year before that.
Yeah,
basically.
A year before that, and it, I mean, that was, shit was, you know,
right.
That was other level. So, And then it got to the thing where I was really passionate about writing songs, but I was also equally as passionate about drumming.
Right.
So I didn't want to forego one for the other, and I always messed around with guitar. So I'd write the song. I'd write a lot of the songs. I'd write a lot of the lyrics. But for me, always in my life, I've had a really big problem with writing lyrics because they're such a personal thing, mm-hmm. and then handing them to somebody else.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm like, set a mic up next to my drum set and let's do this. And then that morphed into when we go out and play, I'd actually put my drum set at the very front of the stage and turn it sideways because I'd sing over the hi-hat. And then that way I could be right in people's faces while I did it. And they could see the fact that I was doing these crazy double bass rolls. And I think a lot of times we would close the set playing Rain and Blood from Slayer.
Right.
And I'd be singing it and playing it. And I remember that just used to fucking trip people out.
Was that hard for you to get that transition of not only, I mean, because I sing backups and play reggae basically.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, how was the transition for you doing playing absolute amazing thrash metal and lead singing? Was it one of the things where it like was a challenge, and once it clicked, you kind of got it? Or
so at very first, you know, when you get the coordination of something down, there's always a little bump of like getting used to it and like nailing it down. But then, you know, it was something where you're playing every day, you're doing it every day, and then I could remember, like, you know, towards the end of like the run of closing the shows out like that, I literally caught myself a couple times being like in the height of the thing, doing the double bass roll and the scream and all this. And my mind is straight up like, oh shit, I didn't send that person that email. You know what I mean? Like, you're just like, it's a such muscle memory that you can just be completely like, fuck, that's right, I forgot to do that. They're going to be pissed off.
Yeah. Yeah. God, and let me tell you something. That takes a special person, man.
Conor McGregor has the best line ever. He said, there's no such thing as talent, only obsession. And back, you know, that's one thing I think music's given me is just obsession. Like, I used to lock myself in my room and in my rehearsal room every day for just hours and hours and hours. And I'd never come out because there was never... That's why I was so pale. Everyone used to think I was like a twack head. But right. It was like, no, I'm just spend all my time in a room with no windows.
Right. It's so funny. Go back to you seeing that that Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson show. It's so funny how you say it was such a big spectacle. It was so larger than life that you could never imagine yourself doing this thing. It's because I had this similar thing when I was young, and my mom worked for a promoter and took me to all these, like I've talked about before, actually in the first episode. And when my mom took me to Metallica and Justice for All, and then I met the dudes.
No way.
And that's what in my mind took that away of, oh wait, these are regular people. It's not this larger than life. So that just, it made me think of that when you said that. Cause at first, before that, it was the same thing. It was like, whoa, this is like these huge larger than life dudes. There's no way this is ever anything close to my world. So
yeah, I mean,
and then it was the strung out incident or strung out
the strung out incident
was the thing that pulled it all together for you.
Yeah,
like me meeting Lars basically.
Exactly. And you know it's cool now that like that got me into music, because you know I would have never been able to see a Pantera show. If the first show I saw was Pantera, I would have had the same reaction. But punk rock was my introduction and into music, into a lot of my philosophy with life. You know, punk rock gave me the bravery and confidence to try anything without anything but just tenacity and passion. You know, I mean, I'm there's a prime example. I mean, I'm, you know, right now currently a part owner of a company that develops high-tech software, and I can't even fucking use that calculator app on my phone.
Does this have anything to do with the board game?
No, that has to do with Odzilla.
With Odzilla,
yeah. Which is so I mean, and even with the game, you know, I make a bunch of money now off selling a board game where people draw dicks and act out coat hanger.
Yeah, I can't keep up. You got so much stuff going on since like we last were like, I guess like hanging out that since we reconnected, it's so awesome to see everything you are doing. And let's talk about it, because I was telling him all about the board game. It's called Draw What?
Yeah, it's called Draw What, and I got into games, which, I mean, that's the point. It all ties back into punk rock. I have no experience in designing games. I have I don't have a college education or anything, but, you know, I have always been hyper creative as well as Dave. So we started
your brother, Dave.
Yeah. When we came off the road, we kind of like happenstanced our way into, like, I was babysitting my friend's kid one day, and he was showing me a lot of his video games, and he went to sleep, and I was just kind of bored, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to design a video game for no other reason than I'm just going to design it, pull up my PDF and all this stuff. And, you know, I designed a game, and then I forget exactly how it happened, but it got into the hands of somebody who actually worked at a gaming company. And they loved it, and they like wanted to like, they wanted to sign it and make it like kind of like an album. And then I asked them.
Just sorry to interrupt real quick, but just for like, I guess your average person out there, you're saying you got up on your PDF and you like designed something that got into someone's hands, like just to make it more tangible, I guess. What do you mean?
Okay,
like,
cool.
Just so, like what it looked like?
Yeah. Or, so what I would do is
let's not give people the Marilyn Manson okay. Nine Inch Nails version.
So this is what I did. I sourced. I was super bored, and I started to geek out on this program called Keynote for Apple. And Keynote, you can like make these cool almost like PowerPoint presentations, right?
Right.
So I came up with the idea of making a video game around Honey Boo Boo's ridiculous family and all the redneck shit. And I called it the Hicks, right? And yeah. So I just started sourcing all these hilarious redneck drawings from Google Images, and I'd crop out the characters, and then I'd find a cool background I liked, and I cropped it out, and I'd make these ridiculous games like the Fart Flyer, where you could have to eat a bunch of beans, and it was kind of like Angry Birds. You ran off a cliff and farted and tried to knock a bunch of things over, you know? So, you know, just using my fucking keen imagination. Yeah. So, you know, and then all you have to do is like Google brown cloud burst, right? So I would get a brown cloud burst, and I'd cut that out, and I'd place it right behind a redneck's butt so it looked like he was farting and propelling himself forward. So I just kind of like almost had the first way they made South Park with construction paper. I just copied together and made these little worlds and like typed out how the levels would go. And keep in mind, this is strictly only for my own fucking amusement, never meaning to show anybody.
Yeah.
So then it got into the hands of somebody who then brought me into this game, gaming company called Pintail. And they're like, look, we love this. We want to make this game. And then it was kind of like, oh, cool. How much money do video games make? And then they told me, and I almost fucking passed out. Like, right. I had no idea. Like, I mean, the top free video game in the App Store now makes $6 or $7 million a day. Every day.
Wait, top three apps?
No, have you heard of Clash of Clans?
Oh, that probably makes a shitload of money.
It makes like $6 or $7 million a day.
And it's a free game.
And it's free. Well, yeah. It's free with air bunny quotations in the air, because they get you, they're free. They're like, oh, but you want this shit. It's like a drug addict. It's like they'll give you their free bag of Coke for free, their first bag for free. But then they're like, ooh, well, you want another line? You could wait 45 minutes or you could pay me 99 cents now for it.
Right.
Yeah. So then they were like, look, we love this. This is how much money they make. And I'm like, well, cool. Well, how much, what would the split be? And then they were pretty much like, well, we'll give you a happy meal and we'll keep everything.
Right. Of course.
So, you know, me being like, you know, fuck that. I went and then I illegally downloaded a program, which I forget the name of now, off the internet, that allowed me to develop the game to a certain point, like a demo of the game that you couldn't play, but I could play through. And I stayed up every night watching YouTube tutorials to pull it off. So I illegally downloaded it, watched a bunch of YouTube tutorials, got it to a point where then I could go show an investor, went and showed an investor, raised the money, made it myself, and started I'm Holding Games.
Yeah.
That game's actually still in production, funny enough. But then that just kind of parlayed us into, okay, cool, now we're making video games, which is like, how is this my life now? Which is so much fun, and the people in that. So one night we're playing Pictionary and we're bored as shit. We have game nights at my house and I'm just drawing dicks on everything, or I'm just trying to make everything in Pictionary like out of dicks,
right?
You know, if it's like airplane, I'm trying to make a dick a plane.
Yeah.
So I said to
just a dick with wings.
Just a dick with wings, right? You know. So I said, you know, flip open the computer. Let's buy the Cards Against Humanity version of Pictionary.
Yeah.
And much, much, much to my shock, it did not exist. I mean, this is a year and a half ago. We looked and looked. And here's the thing. If I can't find you on Google in 15 minutes, you don't exist. Right. I don't even give a fuck if you do exist. You don't exist.
It's good policy these days. Yeah.
So I went into my office the next morning. I put out my hand to my financial partner. I'm like, write me a check. We're making this game. And then we got into it, and the game's hilarious. So it's a mixture between, it's called Draw What. It's a mixture between Pictionary and charades. Our game pieces are little mini butt plugs with smiley faces. They're heroin squares. If you land on a heroin square, you lose your turn and you got to go to rehab. If you land on an Adderall square, it doubles your roll.
Now, of course.
And you have to draw everything from, like, you know, Blumpkin, cocaine overdose, coat hanger abortion, just crazy stuff. And then we kind of made it like, oh, let's see if we could sell a couple. And then it just started taking off.
How much did that have to do with those? Don't you guys have kind of viral commercials that you guys have done, which are fucking hilarious, by the way?
So it's 90. Here's the thing. If our game sucked, it would not have snowballed. So, but without these ridiculous commercials we make, I mean, we made a music video where we had this very stuffy Cape Cod family start to sit down and play Monopoly, and then they were all bored. Then they break out Draw What, and they start turning up. And I had this 80-year-old woman. I direct, write, and edit all these videos. Uh-huh. So I had the 80-year-old woman. And then back to punk rock. The reason I can direct, write, and edit is just be total DIY. I didn't go to school for it. I sat up and watched YouTube tutorials. I got a legal rip of Final Cut Pro, and I've just spent hours watching YouTube tutorials on how to do it.
Right.
You know, so we write everything ourselves. So
it's going back to that saying, obsession.
Yeah, obsession.
You know?
Yeah. So I had this 80-year-old woman. I'm like, all right, so what I need you to do is I need you to act out coat hanger abortion. I need you to rip the baby out, crack its neck, and then like cradle it to sleep. And then so she's like, okay, does that scene. And then I have her snorting coke off her grandson's hand to like end the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So our videos just get either just crazy hate mail, but that's like 10% of it.
Uh-huh.
Or just outlandish like love. Our last commercial ended with an Asian father and a white woman having a baby, and then the baby comes, because it's all about return policy, you get free returns. The baby comes out and the baby's black, and the Asian man just shoves it back in his wife.
I think I've seen that one. I think that one's come across before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, they do really well for us.
Right. And that's just for the board game?
Yeah, that's version? Just for Draw What.
Right.
Yeah. And
there's no digital version of Draw What.
No, it's just that experience is about getting people to put down their phones, look at good each call. Other in the yeah. eyes, and just have a good laugh. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's really cool. I mean, we got a bunch of letters after the day after Christmas that, and as lame as this sounds, I almost got emotional because it was so many people, family saying, I can't tell you, we had the best Christmas ever. Like watching my 58-year-old uncle act out rolling on ecstasy was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my fucking life.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just love stuff that equates to people just not taking themselves too seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and letting down those barriers and those guards or whatever and whatnot.
Yeah.
That's rad. So yeah, everyone check out Draw What, including Draw ourselves. What?
Yeah,
Mitch.
No, I think I'm gonna go buy
we're gonna,
it.
Yeah, we're gonna check out Draw What.
My fiance's birthday is in 2 days. So
nice. Yeah. Well, dude, I'll send you guys some games for
that's
sure.
Amazing. Hey, but then also the Oddzilla thing he was talking about, this is something that sounds like you. I know you briefly told me about it when I saw you last.
Yeah.
When we kind of reconnected a bit, but it's, and I, Mitch, I don't think I've ever told you about it, but
no.
You know, there's kind of a big thing these days, Instagram, social media, and everyone.
It's
you
just
know,
a little the, thing you made
just
heard
a little
of it.
Thing. Oh. A little thing.
Yeah.
And you know, and just content is so huge right now, but for live music and people recording with their phones as fans. They're posting just the most blown out
shit ever.
Just shit that doesn't sound like anything.
Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Adam and team are creating this software called Oddzilla that it turns quality recordings from your phone from like right in front of the PA speakers
so
at a live show.
To elaborate on that, and this is by far the thing I'm most passionate and excited about, I'm working about, because we get up on stage, as I'm sure you do, we play for like 10,000 people, like opening for Korn. Like, this is fucking amazing. You crawl off stage and every video you find of yourself sounds like absolute horrid shit.
Yeah.
And it sucks for the artist and it sucks for the fans. What we do is actually stream the high definition signal from the audio board and marry it to your phone. We master it on the spot in our server in real time and feed it back to your phone. So you're getting the actual board quality. Like if you've ever seen a concert streamed to your home, like how it arrives, how good it arrives in your laptop, that's what we're giving to the users to the user's phone.
That's really fucking cool.
Yeah.
So what's this? I mean, this is going to go into a little tech nerd shit, yeah. But we've got a tour in 3 weeks.
Hey, someone, so yeah, someone needs to do it, man.
How does that work on the audio end? Like so if we're going out in 3 weeks, I do front of house for them. Okay. And I'll be honest, I check phone mixes, not my mix, but like I listen to other people's phones just to hear what it sounds like from their perspective.
Yes. Because
you can still tell a good mix from an iPhone speaker, if it's far enough away, if it's close to the PA, you're fucked.
You're fucked.
Because the low end destroys the fucking, it just blows out the.
Or if you're at the forum and you're up in the nosebleeds, yeah, but it sounds like it's it's at the end of a hall, which is really, you know, that's the rad part of it. You could be buried in the subwoofer, or you could be at the nosebleeds of Dodger Stadium, and it's gonna sound the same.
So what do I need if we were to do that for Pepper?
So what it is
the console.
So what it is it's a back-facing application that you need to either bus your mix to a track,
right.
And then we take it from that track into our console, back-facing app, stream it to our server, and then from here, I'll show you the front-end application is this thing right here called Audzilla, and it...
That's just the beta or something?
Yeah, this is just the beta. So, and then this, all it is it's strictly a tool. It's a camera tool, and then directly from this, you share out to Facebook, Instagram, or Snapchat. It's not its own platform. We cap the videos out at 60 seconds because so you can't bootleg entire concerts or songs, and no one has a fucking attention span more than 60 seconds anyway.
Yeah, right.
And it's solely to...
Max.
Yeah, it's solely to empower every fan to be a high-quality content generator for the artist. And then on top of that, what we do for an extra level of package, because we work with the artists and the venues to do this. God damn it, Beef. So we also mount high-def cameras. We can come in and mount high-definite camera vantage points of like, you know, we could put one behind Yassad, and we could put one just aiming straight at Brett and Clow. And then that way, if I'm in the nosebleeds and I'm taking a video and the video is 60 seconds, I can hit video blend, and then it marries my video and auto-edits a clip of the high-definition vantage points. So it's my personal experience married with actual killer vantage points of the artist as well. Because a lot of times my friends... send me videos. Like my buddy sent me a video from Coachella. He's like, dude, you'll never believe this. Marshmello has rainbow flames shooting out of the stage. He was about 50 yards back, and the only thing I could see was a white glowing orb in the distance. You know, you're like, what is that? So we want to make this really killer just thing where if you're close enough or you just want to keep it your video with killer audio, you can do that. But if you also want to actually like get up in the artist's face,
you can
do that as well.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. When he told me that, I was like this. I mean, how many times? I've brought it up to you so many times.
And we're so close. I mean, by the end of next month, we should have version one. And we're very excited. Oh, sorry. We're very excited about testing it out at Pepper shows.
You know what I mean? We've got a week off.
Here's your guy.
I mean, yeah. I would be happy to be the beta tester for that.
Yeah.
Like, easy. Because it's pretty... It sounds like, from our perspective, you'd hook up just an interface into a laptop, basically, out of the front of house desk.
Yeah, well, we run it into... right now, what we're doing, we're eventually going to have our own built-out patented hardware module, but we run out into, like, an Apogee Duet, and then from the Duet into the an iPad that holds our back-facing app.
Oh,
and then,
I see.
And then it streams out, so you get the high-quality signal. It's just strictly to stream it to our server, and then in our server, we just master it on the spot a little bit, nothing crazy. And we warm the signal and give it back.
So does it sync with the video then? Does it match and sync?
Perfectly. The only thing is after you take your video and you stop, it has like a 3 second render time where it, like, a render screen comes up.
Oh, right. Okay, so I see. So I didn't understand this at first. But it's using the sync profile off of the back facing app.
Yes. So it time codes. So it knows exactly when you're...
How the fuck do you do that with your regular camera phone? You have to shoot it with the
Audzilla camera.
With the app.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, that makes way more sense. So they talk to each other and go, hey, this is where I am. This is where I am. Cool. All right. Take the video. Here you go. There's the audio. Oh, that's fucking smart as fuck.
Yeah.
Because then you don't need any like technology to match it.
No.
Like, I think someone was doing that, right? At one point where they were like... I think Twitter tried to do something where they could take video from a concert... Not do what you're doing.
Yeah.
But they'd create an edit from like 6 different people's phones.
Yeah, yeah.
So like you're using Periscope, right? And you'd throw your phone up.
Yeah.
And it would capture the video and then like it would like
they'd capture five other people's videos?
And then it would also capture five others, and then it would create the, like a multi-camera shoot of what you're watching.
Yeah, which is interesting. Yeah, it's definitely interesting.
But I don't think it ever really, that never, was that who that, do you know who, what that was?
I roughly know what you're talking about, but it still uses the same audio quality.
Yeah,
and
it
does. It's just like live streaming. It's just kind of like a Periscope on steroids.
Yeah.
It doesn't solve necessarily the problem. It doesn't
solve any of the problems you're talking about.
Yeah.
No, so that's really cool.
And we're like, I'm under the firm belief that, you know, you're talking about people who are music fans, and one, first and foremost, people who are music fans love the artists they're going to see, right?
Yeah.
But then you're also talking about kids who, like, in a sense of Coachella or festivals, and spend like $300 for a ticket, drive 6 hours, get a hotel, spend $10 on a bottle of water, and you're going to tell them for free, because it's completely free to the consumer, no ads or anything, you touch a button and you can have this camera that you can, because you can save to your camera roll too, but you can actually document the experience as it happens, as it sounds.
Right.
So it's you know, it's definitely the hardest part is in marketing a new thing is always getting people to sign on, get the early adapters on. But we're confident that once these videos start going out and getting shared around and kids are like, wait, how come your video sounds fucking amazing and my video sounds like an old man coughing into a microphone?
Yeah. As a fan, they're going to own it so much. You know what I mean? Like that content that they love getting as it is. They're going to own it that much more and be so much more proud of it and want to get more. And that just, it's like the perfect ecosystem of the fans are going to be going out there and getting more. It's good for everyone. It's, it's the content's going to sound good.
It's good for the artist, good for the fan.
Better representation of the artist and better fan experience for the fan.
Yeah. I mean, like we're insanely passionate.
I mean, dude, as soon as you have something for me to put on a Pepper show, please let me know.
I'll be hitting you up for sure.
Fucking in a heartbeat.
Is this like the, like,
and Tritonal for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, like he said, once this kind of gets out there, of course people can talk about things, but like you said, when the proof and the pudding get out there, or when the pudding gets out there, the proof will be there.
Yes, man.
But that is just that's so amazing, because I can't wait to see, because it reminds me of like when Hipstamatic or something first came out.
Yeah.
And you could I remember that, and Instagram was like the same thing, and I thought Instagram was just to put like filters on your photos, and that's and Hipstamatic was kind of the same thing. Of course, that's at like the most elementary level, because it's just pictures. This Odzilla almost sounds like it's like that for live shows, for video maybe.
Yeah, and for video, like, and for live. And our goal, our long-term goal is to get folded into a bigger platform like Facebook or Instagram. So like the same way you open up Instagram and you can have just access Boomerang, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's proving the model. And then
what about an Instagram that's just specifically for music, or, you know what I mean? Like,
you know, like, I kind of want to like troubleshoot this with you, but I don't want to waste pod space.
Yeah.
We'll talk after.
But I'd like to say, all boiling back, I like to take it back to punk rock. I mean, punk rock and drumming. It's like, look at the different things I'm working on. It's like, I would have never had the tenacity to try any of this shit, because I'm not a tech head, or I'm not a this or that. I'm just a fucking crazy dreamer that, because of punk rock gave me the fuck it. No, you know what? I don't care. Fuck it. It's a good idea. I'm going to go and I'm going to try it and I'm going to see it through the end. Well, that, and then, you know, sobriety to a sense as well, because, you know, when, you know, I used to fucking party all the time back in the day.
Right.
And when you're living in a tour bus, it's pretty acceptable. And when I decided I wanted, you know, I didn't, you know, I was 26, feeling like I was 56. I decided I, you know, wanted to like do a hard reset of my life and approach it in a different way. When you have that, you have to take that energy that you were putting into that and aim it towards something else.
Right, which can be a lot of energy.
Yeah, a lot of energy. And I'll say this. There's nothing wrong with fucking, I think for people who can handle it, I mean, partying's a necessary part of life. You work your ass off, you go out, you have this or that. But the most important part of life is balance. And I had gotten to a point where I just lost balance of what I was doing. So I decided, look, this isn't how I want to be operating anymore. I want to make some adjustments in my life. So that the empty space that provided me, and all the anxious energy I had, like, you know, when you first stop partying, you want to keep partying.
Right.
It's not like, I'm going to stop partying. Like, you know, so I had to take that shit and I had to push it into other things, which is why, you know, with the film editing and the stand-up comedy and the games and the this or the that. And it's,
which is why you're able to sit up and watch YouTube videos.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's the compulsion that I put into that. And, you know, it's, you know, since I went, I made it like 3 years without partying. And then, you know, I went back in, and then the past year I've went out a handful of times and raged. And unlike my earlier self, there's four dozen things I like more than partying now. So when I do go out and party, I'm able to just wake up the next day, feel like the Crypt Keeper for 3 days because I'm old as shit now. And then I just hop right back on the program. But I mean, it's a mixture between punk rock and then taking all that energy and aiming it towards different shit.
Totally. What kind of touching back on the whole like punk rock thing, because I mean, the studio we're in right now, you've recorded here.
Yeah.
We've had so much history go down in this room. It was funny when he first rolled in here, he was in the live room and points over to the other side like, oh, so stall number two is right over here, right? And I'm like, no, this is stall number two.
Shout out Darian Rundle.
Yeah, shout out to, you're on Front Street, buddy.
Yeah, right?
Oh my God.
Yeah, do you think the other side of the punk rock thing, like it's double-edged sword, blessing and curse, like you're saying.
Yeah.
You think the other side of it is it's made you a little more jaded towards the music industry and not as, because I kind of relate it to just being in the music industry for so long. I will, in my mind, throw my opinion towards something and kind of double check myself like, yeah. Oh man, is that because I've been like in a band and in the music industry for so like a long time and am I just being a like jaded old guy?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, especially when I was in punk rock, that was the only thing that was acceptable. But more so than that, I mean, punk rock gave me very allergic reactions to words like responsibility and discipline. You know, I thought that if you had responsibilities and you were disciplined, you were like a fucking conformist somehow. Uh-huh. And, you know, and discipline was this fucking shackle. People were slaves who were disciplined. You know, I was free to do whatever I want. Well, that's pretty funny. You're free to do whatever you want. But I mean, like, what if I wanted to go on vacation to Hawaii? I couldn't really afford it, could I?
Right.
You know, right. You want any type of quality of life, you got to be disciplined to earn it. And that's what I've learned now is I have freedom through discipline. I can pretty much operate and go around. You know, I had it backwards. I was like, well, yeah, sure, you could go to the park and smoke weed all day and not fucking work. Yeah, rad. You could pick up your skateboard and skate down the thing all day, but like,
yeah,
what,
do you want? That's great for some people. Yeah, like more, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, do you want to get a car? Do you want to live in an apartment?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was fucking sleeping in my car 3 years ago. You know what I mean?
That's a quote right there. I like that.
What?
You have to have discipline to truly be free.
Yeah, freedom through discipline.
Freedom through discipline.
Yeah, real. I mean, it's kind of like people get it backwards though sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like trying to get any kind of success and no one thinks that hard work precedes that, you know, and trying to jump ahead of things, kind of the same.
And it's like, you know, I'll say this because there are days I just slack off and do nothing. There are days my dick doesn't leave my hand, man. Just, you know, but, you know, the most valuable and intangible moments in life are when you push through shit and work for it, and then you're finally standing in front of it, like experiencing it. You know, we live very much in a culture that has an infatuation with instant gratification. Like they want everything immediately. They want to feel good. They
speaking
never
want social media.
Yeah, they never want to feel bad. They never want to be stressed. Everything needs to be copacetic at all times, and that's just absolute bullshit. It's like the pure joy and the real shit lies beyond everything that's hard to do and everything. You know how many dicks I've sucked to get where I am. Not literal dicks.
Yeah.
You know, but right. I mean, it's just like how many times I've been kicked in the nuts and keeping going forward. And it's like when you push through that, you know, because if I just want shit to be easy, you just tap out and be like this. But like you get to these moments, you were like, fuck, man. Like, and I know it's a material thing, but you know, when I went from sleeping in my car on the side of PCH to now having an apartment that overlooks fucking the Pacific Ocean, that was like a fuck. You know, that's like a moment that like that was going to reverberate through me through the end of time. And like, it took a lot of doing things I did not want to do in a lot of days to get there. But that feeling in that moment was you know, paramount. You know, it just couldn't have been earned any other way.
Right.
So, you know, I'm a big believer in sacrificing to get to a greater thing.
Totally. And the whole, like, getting outside of your comfort zone, like you're saying.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And getting through all the stuff till the point that you can stand right in front of it. You know,
yeah.
it is truly amazing. And it's great when you can recognize it too and realize it's happening, you know?
Yeah. And then I just love, you know, back in the day too, I used to think that failure was failure. You know, it's like, I get so amped to fall on my face now. It's like, I get so amped to just whiff so hard because life has been 100% consistent in showing me that all failure is doing is teaching you how the right way to go.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? And it's teaching you appreciation for when you get there. God damn, like, I had to go through all of these things to do it. You know, so the famous Thomas Edison quote, he's like, well, how'd you feel? You know, you try to make a light bulb 10,000 times and it didn't work. He's like, you failed at it. He's like, I didn't fail at it. I just learned 10,000 ways to not make a light bulb.
Yeah. No, I totally, man. I'm such a personally firm believer in, I would love moving forward and making a ton of mistakes instead of just sitting in one place and trying to overthink everything to a point where you're still just sitting there.
Yeah, you're still sitting there. And I hands down have the greatest things in my life today, the greatest relationships, the greatest life out of the shittiest things that have happened to me.
Right.
Like, no one's ever become enlightened fucking watching a reality TV show marathon pounding Haagen-Dazs ice cream. No one's ever leveled up doing that. You always level up when you get like some chick that okay. So back, I'll give you a horrible, shallow example of what I'm talking about. But so the reason I really pursued raising that money and starting my own gaming company is because I was dating this girl at the time who was like adamant on telling me that I was a piece of shit and I was never going to be anything but a piece of shit.
Right.
And then she ran off with her ex-boyfriend, and I was, for 3 days, I was just crippled. Couldn't move. I was drinking like a fucking maniac. You know what I mean? I was just like, just trying to just paralyzed with pain. And then this thing came over me where I was so bummed and I was like, I want to get so rich that this chick just sits in a bathroom and cuts herself thinking about the fact that she's not with me anymore. I mean, as a shitty...
The passion went heavy the other side.
And from that smoldering, like, heartbreak wreckage, I picked myself up and I became laser beam focused on what I'm doing. And then a month into it, that all of that evaporated and I couldn't give a shit anymore. And I was just really loving what I was doing. And it was putting my life on a whole different direction. But I could have just sat there and been like, you know, she's right. I'm a fucking loser and I'm never going to be a loser. And I'm always going to be a loser. But I took that shitty thing that happened to me and I was like, you got to always have a fucking, I'll show you, whether it's the universe or a chick or life itself. You got me, you know, fuck that. I'll show you.
Well, they always say like such, I mean, or I don't know who says this, but such like great things are born out of tragedy at times, you know what I mean? But it's dealing with it in those positive ways or being able to turn it into something positive of instead of I'll show you and I hope you slit your wrists. I'll show you and I'm going to make this the best of me that I can.
The petty revenge angle fades away. Yeah,
whatever gets you there though, you know?
Yeah. There's this cool book. Have you ever heard of this book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill?
No.
It's cool.
Have you, Mitch? No, I haven't.
It's a guy he hung out with Gandhi, with Ford, with Andrew Carnegie, with Thomas Edison. I mean, he spent 20 years living with these people, studying the common traits they had in place before he wrote this book about like pretty much mental riches and how all successful people share these things. And he said, it's always cool, you know, he's like, whatever your version of God is, whether it's the universe or a traditional Christian Judeo God or anything, he's like, it's always cool to say the following. He says, dear God, I pray not for more riches, but for more wisdom to make wiser use of the riches you gave me at birth and the power to direct my mind to whatever ends I desire. So what that's pretty much saying is everyone is equally rich when they're born because they're given a brain that they have complete control over.
Right.
And it's only through life that you start to sacrifice that control to worry and to stress and to depression and things like that. And you start to forego your control to the point where you can train your brain to just be completely beyond your control. But I mean, I think you look at somebody like Chester Bedingfield and you look at somebody like Chris Cornell from the outside looking in, who have all the fucking money and success you want in the world, but that shit is never happiness. So if you remain rich inside your mind and focus on what you're rich about, the rest of that shit will come. And he's like, that's what every single one of these people had. They also had blinding ambition, but they had this core sense of just, you know, the control over their mind and appreciation for what they were grateful for that allowed things to just stick to them, success and positivity to stick to them.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned someone like, you know, God rest their souls, Chris Cornell or Chester Bennington, and then you think about someone on the complete other side who's probably, you know, equally as you know, successful, renowned, even more and whatnot, but someone like John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the reason I thought of it is because you think about all that stuff that invades your mind and starts tarnishing it and diluting it and whatnot. But I always remember reading the Led Zeppelin Hammer of the Gods book, and they claim how John Paul Jones is the only one that got out of Led Zeppelin unscathed because he was never really like in the limelight.
Yeah.
He was, but if it wasn't for him, you know, who knows if there would be Led Zeppelin,
because
he was so in the studio side of them, was such an integral part and whatnot. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know, that's, I guess, the polar opposite, I guess, that I thought of, that where he's probably one of those guys that maybe was just, that you're talking about, was like, I just want to make sure I'm happy and I'm rich mentally.
Yeah.
And then all the other stuff will come. And maybe that was a decision he made well before Led Zeppelin, during Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Who knows? But it just, you know, just kind of, that's what I initially thought of the two paths you take of maybe, and I don't know if John Paul Jones is totally happy, but just on the surface, you know, and he's probably a 70-year-old guy or in his 60s or.
Probably 70s.
And then how sad it is of people like Chester and Chris that choose to end their life in their 40s, late 40s or something.
Yeah.
And it's, like I said, it's the two exact opposite ends of the road.
Yeah.
Do you meditate?
Yes, to the extent that I can, because my brain very much is a bag of squirrels. Like, but I can do the mentally focus on one thing mantra thing.
You know what I mean?
Well, I can just focus on like, you know, I grab onto my gratitude list. I grab onto those things and I can sit there and run through them meticulously and meditate that way. But as far as the clear your mind meditation, I've never been capable of that, just because I always... You know, you can tell how much I'm running my fucking mouth in this thing. I'm talking twice as much up in my head 90% of the times. There's just the difference is back in the day when I used to have trouble falling asleep is because every shitty thing I have ever done and has ever come out of my mouth would be replaying in my head and I couldn't go to sleep. Nowadays, I have to put the TV on to fall asleep because all this rad shit's running through my brain. Oh, maybe we could do this. Maybe we could do that. Maybe I'll write this song or do this. And so my brain's never been a quiet one.
Right. Yeah. I've had that trouble too, because I've gotten into meditation in the last like year.
Really?
Yeah. And the mantra thing helps.
Yeah.
But like, I've also learned that like going, because there's this really awesome app called Headspace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, it's guided. There's also unguided, and I've switched over to the unguided due to my friend Kevin recommending it.
But probably, do you start with the guided one first if you want to go down that road?
Start with the guided, and it gives you all these like steps to take and on the journey like throughout the meditation. And it always reminds you, like, if a thought comes into your head, don't push it out. Push it out, but like don't get upset with yourself for having the thought. Accept that you had the thought and move on.
Yeah.
And it, like, that idea has helped me meditate. And it helps me because then it's like, okay, I'm having this thought. Okay. Oh, I'm having this thought, because I'm kind of like you when I meditate.
Yeah.
And it's helped me a lot. And I feel like a lot of people nowadays who are successful meditate. So that's why I ask.
Yeah, it's because I think it's important. What I just try to do in a sense is break myself free from my own narrative in my brain. Because your mind is constantly narrating your life.
Right.
This is going well. This isn't going well. I want this. I'm scared about that. I mean, there's constantly a fucking, and you know, mine, I'd like mine to sound like Morgan Freeman, but it doesn't. It just sounds like a little twacked out version of myself. Like, maybe this is going to happen. Ah.
Right.
But it's also good. Like when I do that and I focus on my breathing and I just focus on one thing, it separates me from that for right. a time being. And, you know, going back, let's keep tying it back into punk rock. If you would have told me to do this when I was 15, I would have gone, yeah, fag.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Yo, yeah, whatever, that new age bullshit. And then I just learned getting older that it's like, dude, everything within reason is cool and worth a try. You know what I mean? It's like you'd be shocked at some of the shit that you find out about yourself just by doing different shit.
Totally. I think in defense of your young self, though, there's so much more like quote unquote white noise these days in the world with social media.
I can't even imagine.
With just everything, with just media in general, and just how the world is swelling and swelling and swelling in all ways possible, you know? So it's like, I mean, it's almost like meditating is more crucial nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
Than, I mean, I've never even tried it yet or gone down that road like Mitch was saying, he kind of has.
Well, surfing, I think, is...
I was just going to say.
Surfing's like, it could be equated, because what you're just doing is when you're catching a wave, what you do is you're anchored into the moment. You're 100% present. You're not like catching a wave and worrying about your taxes.
No,
you
good call. And I couldn't, like, I would, like...
Yeah.
Surfing is everything to me. It rounds out every rough edge in my world, you know what I mean? Like I've A-B'd it a million times, and when even the presence of surfing and just being, because you know I've gone through rough times in my life where I'm just not, it's not a priority in my life.
Yeah.
And even nowadays where it's one of the top priorities in my life, because you know, just kind of everything's copacetic right now in my mind, even when I don't surf for a long time and we're on tour, still it just being such a top priority in my life, it even smooths out those rough edges,
right?
Kind of.
Right.
You get what I'm saying?
No,
so yeah, I agree with you guys 100%. That's a great point.
Like, you remember we were talking, this is before Chester Bennington passed away, but we were talking about the five guys, like the five singers, and you, this was on my podcast, and you said, you're like, the only person left is Eddie Vedder. And he's going to be fine because he surfs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was my was my theory. It was after Chris Cornell.
Yeah, after Chris Cornell died.
Because that was such a when I heard that, I remember I woke up the morning after or whatever, and I was like, what? Like so confused.
Yeah.
And then just through my pondering of, because, and that hit me so hard because the 90s, that's when, you know, I was born in 79. So during the 90s. And that's what I think. I came straight in the studio and I told Mitch, I was like, dude, you know what? As funny as this sounds, because I'm like a surfer and like whatever, as bro as this sounds or whatever, it's like, honestly, man, I think Eddie Vedder will be just fine, because as far as that grunge era goes and all that, just world changing music, he's the last one left, because I mean, Lane Staley's passed. Scott Weiland's passed.
Yeah.
Obviously, Kurt Cobain's passed.
And if you look at now it too, Chris Cornell's passed. He's the only one that didn't fuck around with heroin either.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's always mind blowing to me how even people try meth or heroin for the first time, because no one's ever had a good heroin story. No one's ever like,
you're not addicted yet, man.
No one's ever been like, well, I shot heroin, got promoted at work, things work out perfectly with the fiance, and you know, everything was happily ever after. Yeah. You always like wind up 6 months later, you're trying to sell your molars on fucking eBay, giving hand jobs behind dumpsters at In-N-Out.
Yeah.
It's like, that's 100% of the stories. So how does somebody be like, you know what? I think it's going to be different with me.
Yeah. The next, this is a good decision.
This is a good decision.
I know. Well, to me, like, speaking of drummers, and I read the NoFX book, and Smelly, you read about, he tells how his come to Jesus moment was, he was inside his parents' garage about to steal their TV and shit to go buy some more junk. And he had and he's been clean ever since from heroin.
Jesus.
From, according to the NoFX book, which is amazing, by the way.
Yeah, I got to check that out.
But yeah, you're so right. It just is the ugliest, like, darkest, sickest thing ever.
I mean, I'll say this straight up. Like, the first time I did ecstasy, it changed my life. I was 16 years old. And I rolled around with a group of people who drank 40s, listened to angry punk rock music. I didn't stop listening to punk rock after I did E, but would go to parties and look for people who are different than us, get drunk enough, and beat the shit out of them.
Yeah.
That was the thing. I rolled around big shit-kicking dudes, and that was like our pastime, and we loved that. And then I took E one time, and I had this thing like, I'm doing life all wrong. I shouldn't be finding people who are different than me and fighting them. I should be befriending them and trying to like learn more about them and reaching out and making connections with people, as opposed to running with the same four dudes and creating enemies wherever I go. And I didn't take ecstasy again for years after that, but that one experience smacked me across the face and I just snapped out of it. I stopped fighting, never stopped listening to punk rock. So obviously I played forever, but that whole mentality, it totally changed how I operated. Now,
you're one of the most outgoing people I know too, by the way, and I love it. It's so awesome. So you think that seed was planted right then?
Well, here's the thing. I was always outgoing and had a good whip in my mouth, and you know, I always could, you know, was very witty and off the cuff, and could be very endearing. But I was just very rooted in like negative bullshit. Like we'd go to parties and I'd steal bongs from people and like just dumb, ignorant shit that I shouldn't be fucking doing. And I remember when I got kicked out of my high school and had to go to a continuation school. And then I came back my senior year.
Was that Malibu High?
Malibu High. And I, you know, when I left, I made two teachers resign when I left because they were just, I tortured them so much. Not in a way that you would think, like, I was very sharp and I knew exactly what to say to people to fuck them up in their head. Yeah. You know what I mean? I wasn't like throwing spitballs. I remember this one teacher who in my defense was an absolute tenured old crotchety nightmare who was just mean to everybody. Uh-huh. So she pulled me out. She's like, I want to talk to you outside of class one time. And so she pulled me right out of class. And before she even got a word in her mouth, I said, you know what? I'm going to say something first. I think being a teacher is one of the most noble things you can do. You guys don't get paid a lot of money. And I'm like, you're making an impact on people's lives. But I'm like, you, I don't get it. Everyone just hates you. And you're just an old fucking joke.
Holy
and she shit. Just like went pale white, broke up, cried, and then was literally like resigned the next week. Like, I did that to a person. And whether she deserved it or not, I think about it to this day and I fucking cringe. So I had that kind of, I left school, I had that awakening moment, totally changed how I started. I've always had a really big heart. So I started just like turning that on, and all that other shit was posturing and fake bullshit to seem cool. So I shed all that shit. And then I came back my senior year, and halfway through the first semester, my English teacher comes up to me. She goes, what the fuck happened to you? And I'm like, why? She's like, do you know that when people found out you were coming back to this school, the certain teachers said they would fucking quit if we put you in their class. And she's like, I had to sack up and I volunteered and took you. And she's like, you are hands down my favorite student, my best student. You volunteer, you break up fights in the quad. Uh-huh. You're like, what the fuck happened to you? And I wasn't going to be like, IAD.
Yeah.
Because it really had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, right.
You know, but that's the thing. It's the real shit. It's like... You know, the truth is you're worthy of great things, but your ego will just tell you you're great. Your ego is like, you're great, which that's just bullshit.
Right.
You know, the truth is you're worthy of great things if you show up and participate in it. So, you know, with meth, with things like that, there are drugs, like there are hallucinogenic drugs, like things that I think can have benefits to people. Can I tell you my worst meth story right now real quick?
Let's do it.
So on tour... Wichita, Kansas, opening for Korn. I used to always end the show with this huge speech about how music is my best friend.
So it was 2 cents.
2 cents and Korn.
And Korn.
And
this
was
in Kansas.
This is in Wichita, Kansas.
Wichita,
yes.
Kansas.
So I used to end this speech with how, you know, music was my first best friend, and it's, you know, this intangible thing that brings everyone together, and it's blah, 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 touchy-feely bullshit.
Yeah.
And then end it with, you know, and we're going to be hanging out all night. Come find us. Let's fucking have a drink and let's smoke a bowl, whatever you guys want. It was my way of connecting with the fans and hanging out with them after the show.
Right.
Well, it was top secret at the time. I didn't really smoke weed. I had a way of like fake smoking weed because weed just turned on me when I was 26, just started giving me panic attacks. But I wanted that like moment to give with the fans. They pack you a bowl and you're like, oh, look what's over there. And you hand them back to pipe, right? So these two shit kicking guys, like 6 feet tall, 6'3", with four teeth between them, come up and they're like, hey, man, this guy's just got one fucking tooth, man, hanging out his top gum. And he's like, hey, brother. He's like, hey, man. First thing he says to me, he's like, I used to bench 350 in high school. I'm like, fucking fantastic, bro.
Right on.
Great, great opener. He's like, so he's like, hey, man, you want to come outside and smoke a bowl with us? So I can't be like an elitist. So I'm like, yeah, okay, let me go fucking pretend to fucking fake smoke your shitty weed.
Yeah. I'll fake smoke with anyone.
Yeah, let's do it.
Opportunist.
So... walks me outside, hands me the pipe, him and his friend, and I go to fake smoke, and I pan down, and I look, and in the pipe, it's like yellow glass shards. And I'm like, bro, I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, what the fuck is this? He's like, oh, man, it's fucking meth, bro. I'm like, dude, I'm like, I'm not about to fake smoke meth with anybody. Yeah. I ain't about to fake smoke meth. So I'm like, no, dude, I don't do this. He said, oh, man, you don't fucking smoke meth, man. You don't even know what you're missing, brother. It's like riding the tiger through the heavens or whatever the fuck pitch he gave me. And then right as he's saying this, the top fucking tooth in his fucking face comes out and sticks to his bottom lip. He lost his tooth mid-meth rant. Mid-meth rant, he lost his tooth. Now it's just sticking to his lip and talking to me like this. And I'm just like trying... I'm just like trying to not fucking throw up in his face, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, bro, you got a hitter right here, bro. You got your fucking tooth is on your lip. He's like, oh, man. He's like, pull this out. He goes, Scott, it happened. He goes, we're going to get so many resin hits off this thing, brother. And he put his tooth in the fucking pipe and fucking started taking a resin hit of his tooth. Then.
Meth resin?
Meth resin off his tooth.
That's a thing.
And then
I didn't learn that in Breaking Bad.
And then he passed it to his friend and his fucking friend hit it. I was just like, what the fuckity fuck? And I was like, oh man, yeah, why don't I do this drug?
The fucked up thing is what I'm thinking is, imagine, I mean, how many teeth do you have in your mouth? That's how many times that happened before.
Yeah.
That same instance with other people. Yeah, I mean, every tooth must have came out on his bottom lip during a meth rant.
Do you think they smoked resin off of a previous tooth? So that's how they knew that there was resin on the tooth?
To be honest with you, I didn't.
How did they figure that out? Yeah, exactly, like, Mitch. How did they figure that out? That there's actually meth resin on this tooth. Like you said, the things you don't learn from Breaking Bad.
Oh, no. Man.
I learned a lot, but not that.
Those are the drastic difference between certain drugs, children.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Amazing. But, I mean, back to what you're saying, though, that whole realization for you, it wasn't because of the ecstasy. It just, you were able to look at something in a different way.
Yeah.
And saw that, wow, I like the way this looks this way better and carry it with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the thing. The cool thing about being a human is when you are presented with the truth, You know it. You don't maybe know it in the frontal lobe of your brain, but it's this frequency that reverberates.
Would you call that your gut feeling?
Yeah, throughout your whole body, gut, heart, or whatever. Yeah. And I think a lot of the reason, you know, that's how they get a lot of people into, and I'm not knocking it at all, like, but that's how they get a lot of people into organized religion, because they say a lot of these things that we all know are true, like forgiveness is powerful, treat other people how you want to be treated. You got all these things that, like, you don't even need to be told. And then the second you hear them, your body starts to tingle. You're like, yes, that is right. And then they're like, but you can't eat meat on Friday. And you're like, wait, hold on a second. And you can't fuck dudes. You're like, wait, hold on a second. You know what I mean? Wait, hold on. Well, you had me. You're left turning this. So yeah. To me, organized religion is the truth of the universe wrapped in the agendas of men. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because they hook you in with this shit that is like, is scientific fact or frequency that frequencies and truths that run through everything. And then they attach their own little bullshit at the end, like a disclaimer, like also may not marry dudes. And you know,
yeah, totally.
all these other things. So, you know, when I had that moment, but E was the catalyst, but it's the same thing. I mean, with like acid, that's scientifically proven, that opens up neural pathways in your brain you can't access without it. Right. And I'm not sitting here like, advocating to do it. I'm just talking about scientific facts of like how certain drugs affect certain people. You know what I mean? Like if you've ever been on cocaine before, it's like cocaine, all you want to do is you're like, you need a drink, then you want to fucking, then you want another drink, and then you want to talk to this person, but fuck this person, I hate this person, I want to fucking take a shit now, and I want to fuck, but I can't. It's just like, it's just 10 second little increments of I need this, I need that, I need this.
Right.
You know, it's just it's like almost taking a telescope and turning it backwards and looking at it. You can only see the 6 inches in front of your face.
Right.
And then
right.
You just get in a fist fight with your dick at the end of the night. It's an ugly thing.
Yeah, totally. No one wants that. Nobody wants that. That's like the opposite of the Godzilla thing where that's just good all around for the world, you know?
Yeah.
This is, you don't want that.
Yeah, you don't want that. Yeah.
All right. Hey, so before we let you go though, let's nerd out on some drum stuff a little bit.
Yeah!
So back to Pantera. Would you say Vinnie Paul is one of your favorite drummers of all time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Number one?
You know what?
I'm a Vinnie Paul motherfucker.
There was a time in my life that I would have said yes, but wholeheartedly. But now, since music stopped being in like a specific order and kind of spread out horizontally to be like my favorite things, like sit in a horizon as opposed to like a, you know, a
totem pole.
Yeah, exactly.
I like it.
But absolutely Vinnie Paul, absolutely John Bonham, absolutely Dave Grohl. I mean, fucking Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl's performance at the 1993 MTV Video Awards when he played Rape Me, and it almost looked like his head was playing the snare drum. He was headbanging so hard.
And that was back in the day when he had the super high hi-hat that was like above his head.
He still has a pretty high hi-hat.
Yeah, it's lowered a little bit though, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, and he was rocking like the 16-inch rack tom biggest like rack. Oh,
maniac.
I know. I'm so with you, because I would say, I mean, I think you too, Mitch, as a drummer, because there's the other side of drumming where you're more of a Neil Peart guy and you're more of a technical guy, you know, where I'm more along your sides of the feel pocket kind of vibe as
Keith
far as...
Keith Moon?
As far... Oh, so you are a Keith Moon guy.
Oh, fuck, yeah.
Okay.
We've discussed this. We feel that there's a 50% in favor of Keith Moon and 50% out of favor with Keith Moon.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, actually. So, because I'm not a big Keith Moon guy. Like he doesn't use a hi-hat, which just instantly kind of throws me off. And I get I love his passion. I love his energy. His drumming, I'm not the biggest fan of, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm not thinking of any like specific grooves off the top of my head. I have the visual of him.
Whereas you think John Bonham and you think of grooves instantly, right?
Yeah.
The
opening.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah. And then the reason I never got into Neil Peart is I just couldn't get past that fucking dude's voice.
Geddy Lee?
I couldn't get 10 seconds into his voice. It sounded like he was getting a proctologist exam. Every time, I just couldn't do it. And I'm not knocking Rush fans. They're all super talented. But And then when I put it on mute and watch him play, I'm like, yeah, he's shredding.
Yeah.
But I've seen drum solos.
But it's two different kind of drum. Like, it's like you watch a Neil Peart drum solo and you watch a John Bonham drum solo, and they're both absolutely just fucking ripping the shit out of it so hard. But just me personally, Neil Peart's just is too perfect where it's stiff to me personally. And then someone like John Bonham, which, I mean, he based his solo, the famous Moby Dick solo, off Miles Davis, right?
Oh, is that right? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, fucking not Miles Davis.
Oh.
No.
We got dogs.
No, I don't know.
Who let the dogs out? Dated reference.
Yeah. I don't know.
But anyway, point being mainly is the just the two different feels, and which, hey, they're both so badass and awesome in their own sense. It's just, it's all about what you like.
Oh, here's one. Fucking Abe Cunningham from Deftones. That guy's a fucking beast. And just because he's so groove oriented, and you listen to some of those songs and go listen to the Diamond Eyes record, I mean, he's just a fucking animal.
And
I mean,
he's kind of like the best of both worlds, don't you think?
Yeah.
Like, he's got that technical just solidness,
yeah,
but that feel too, that just feels,
well, it's so, the taste. And because then another one who's an absolute beast is Danny Carey from Tool. I mean, I've sat behind him and watched him play, and it just made me want to light my drum set on fire and never play again.
I just saw Tool about a month ago or whatever. I mean, when this comes out, it'll probably be a couple months or a month and a half in San Bernardino, and he is almost, to me, the perfect match of a John Bonham and Neil Peart put together.
Exactly.
Where you listen to these drum parts and you're like, wow, he's playing the most technical shit in the world. But if you weren't paying attention, you almost really wouldn't notice, because it feels so groovy at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the perfect marriage, man. Like, God, yeah. Danny Carey is,
yeah,
like you said, it makes you want to burn your drum set, but then makes you want to go play it at the same time.
Yeah.
You know who I think is really underrated in that category as well is John Theodore.
Dude, I know John.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Mars Volta and Queens of the Stone Age now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was the original drummer for the Mars Volta.
Right.
And all those drum parts on the early records, they're technical, but they have this like amazing pocket. And yeah. there's one song that's in like 13/8.
All weird time signatures, yeah, right? The Mars Volta albums?
What I think is really cool about drummer, like really good drummers and parts in particular, is when you hear the drum part and you think it's really simple.
Yeah.
But then you listen to it and you're like, oh fuck. I got that totally wrong.
Yeah.
I got that completely wrong. And he's like the king of that. And not to say that Thomas Pridgen isn't very good,
yeah.
but I felt like when Mars Volta went to Thomas Pridgen, it just wasn't.
He was too much of a session drummer to me. Like, you know what I mean? He's phenomenal and ridiculous, but
it didn't really work.
I mean, that's, and then going back to Abe Cunningham, I mean, that's just the thing. He's like, his beats sound simple enough, but like, just pull apart Digital Bath. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's a perfect example.
It's the spaces he leaves.
Yeah.
You know, and the way he chooses to piece those things together that just create this ultimate groove. And I think, you know, as a musician, you know, going from punk rock to extreme metalhead to like all this different stuff, it's like, it's pretty fucking easy to be super complicated. You know what I mean? What's really hard is to fucking write a good song that has the appearance and the accessibility of something that's digestible and simple, but has that just left of center approach that makes it unto itself. I mean, if you want to do fucking 64th note sweet picking arpeggiated in a fucking jazz scale, yeah, I'm sure it's going to sound pretty crazy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But can you take the four chords that a lot of people use, and can you do something new with them?
Right.
That's way more challenging, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean,
dude,
that's
totally true.
Like, I think a bunch of people have said it, and I totally agree with it. It's like the space actually in between the notes that you're playing is more important than the notes you're actually playing.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'll do it. And a lot of times I'd track guitar on certain songs. I'd track this guitar line and I'd pull it up and I would just randomly delete sections of it. Not even like calculate it out. I just close my eyes, highlight a section, delete, and then just see how that, what rhythm. Phrase that created, you know, and be like, oh shit. I mean, that's like really, and that comes back into the production, going almost back into a
full circle
to the electronic music production. It's just like producing. I've become so passionate about producing music and not just writing songs that it's like, it's a really interesting thing how you can get to certain places and I feed certain thing, like I feed a guitar through Melodyne and just like crunch it and detune it to a point where it just doesn't even sound like a guitar, but the tone you'll get out of it is like, it's just fucking gross thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that's part of the really cool thing about that genre.
Like, yeah.
You know,
the elasticity.
Just the idea that you can just kind of do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
There are no rules.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And then there's, you know, there's a band called Zed's Dead, and the first song off their last release, Northern Lights, they have this song called Stardust, and they have this tone that it's granted it could fall under the pretenses of EDM, but it's a song. It's got a vocal, it's got a chorus, and it's got this very crunchy mid-ranged fucked up feeding back guitar throughout the verse that is just like, I wouldn't even know what to call that genre of music, but it's just so fucking cool to me. It's like,
right.
And then, oh, here's the other thing, you know, go really quick. What people who, cause rock will come back. It will come back. All the shit will come back.
Yeah.
It's 100% come back. And what people need to understand about rock music is you have to fucking use a sub now. There's no such thing as not sub in music anymore. Like, I'll listen to some trap artists I love. And man, I pulled up Pantera the other day. And it's like laughable how little of low end is in a Pantera record.
Yep, right.
It's fucking embarrassing.
So
it's
never do a Injustice for All Metallica record anymore where they mixed all the bass out of it, basically.
It's what you just do is you got to drop at the octave. You have to run the frequency spectrum if you want to compete. And not only is it even about competing, it's just more appealing. It's like if you want to fucking make someone hit the brown note and drop a couple bacon strips in their undies, you're not going to do that unless you're fucking getting below 50 hertz.
Yeah. I actually just heard a song on Apple Music or whatever. And it was, I can't think of the name of it, but the bass line was not a bass line. It was just an oscillator, basically.
Yeah.
Essentially, like sub 100.
Yeah.
That is just so low that you're like,
yeah.
And it's like, it's kind of pleasing.
Yeah.
That like subharmonic feeling, and it's, then you have the melody floating on
top of it.
I wonder, I can't remember who that was.
Well, most trap music is the bass line is just an 808 kick line
that's
that goes, yeah, that creates a like a you know, a melody.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it just fucking, and when that stuff comes on in your car and fucking hits, gagoosh,
yeah,
it, you know, you take notice, man.
Dude, that's pretty cool.
And just for the record, my bad, the Moby Dick solo.
Oh, you looked it up, huh?
Yeah. Sorry, this isn't a total, not Buddy Miles. He plays horn. But it's a take on Ginger Baker, Buddy Rich, and Joe Morello.
Oh.
Is basically where
Ginger
where,
Baker.
Where
he's
Bonham,
another good one.
Yeah, where Bonham kind of like kind of put all that together to make Moby Dick solo.
And then there you go. One of the best guitar players of all time is Tom Morello. It's like, you know, you talk about somebody who can fucking shred using like four notes.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And then when he wants to turn it on, he can.
His space.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
that is crazy though, because you think about like touching on the whole electronic music thing. Think about his solos on the first, even the first.
Know Your Enemy.
Well, they had to have the disclaimer on that record. You remember on the back cover when music was actually in his physical form on the CD?
Yeah.
It said no synthesizers or keyboards were used in the making of this record.
Yeah.
Because those guitar solos sounded so, for lack of a better term, electronic.
Yeah.
In the middle or early in the 90s. You
know? Man.
So, crazy. The guy, talk about ahead of your time.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, man, hey, we want to thank you so much.
Oh, it was a blast.
For coming down, Adam.
I love all the Pepper Boys. I love you, Saad. I love Cloud. I love Brett. I love you, boys. I miss you.
Yeah. I know. It's been so long since our lives were so intertwined. And hey, like music comes around and rock's coming back. Hey, we're coming back.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
oh, I'm in it.
So, but once again, thank you guys for tuning in to Disposable Heroes. Number four. Real
quick, where can we find you on Instagram, Twitter, or anything like that?
Yeah,
you
good
any
call.
You can find me on Instagram, and you can see a bunch of really fucked up green screen movies I've made with my dog and understand that I have mental problems. It's a hashtag, but you have to spell hashtag, #HASHTAG _ Adam O, ADAMO.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's just on Instagram then?
Yeah, I'm just on Instagram. I haven't gotten into the tweets yet, mainly because, you know, when I drink, the last thing I need is a public forum, like Twitter.
Right.
It's like...
Yeah, that's the demise of a lot these days, is social media and phones and people hammered.
On the rare occasion I do drink, the last thing I need to have on my phone is Twitter, so people can understand, like, so people can misinterpret my sense of humor.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Amazing. Right on. Thanks again, brother. And thanks, everyone, for joining us on another episode of Disposable Heroes. Hoorah.
Rock and roll.